Although Allied troops were acquainted with their enemy's sacrificial nature, they were unprepared for what came out of the sky during the Battle of Leyte Gulf in October 1944. Japanese pilots flew their planes and themselves directly into American warships, causing massive damage. So attacked, the USS St. Lo sank with 114 hands, the first, but far from the last, victim of the kamikazes. A recent PBS production summarized the effect of suicide attacks by Japanese pilots during World War II. But who were the men that got into those Japanese planes knowing that they wouldn't be coming back? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
Where did the concept of the kamikaze come from? Did anyone in Japan question the idea of those suicide missions? And what sort of record have those pilots left us? Our guest is Emiko Unuki-Tierney, professor of anthropology at the UW-Madison and author of Kamikaze Diaries, Reflections of Japanese Student Soldiers, published by the University of Chicago Press.
And welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you.
I noticed in your preface to your other book, Kamikaze, Cherry Blossoms, and Nationalisms, that you write about your emotional reaction, that you became obsessed with the story of the kamikaze pilots, these young men, very educated, and their tragic ends, and that you developed increasing rage and insomnia. Can you say something about your journey with this topic of the kamikaze pilots and the diaries they left behind?
Yes, it was a very unusual research for me because I started out as a very innocent understanding of all the Japanese celebrating and enjoying cherry blossoms until somebody pointed out that cherry blossoms were deployed by the military state to encourage young people, or the old Japanese for that matter, to fall like beautiful cherry petals after a short life. And so my research, after 2 years, my research just turned around, and I really started to see who they were, and then also the historical processes which led to this tragic end. And as I said, that in retrospect, it is outrageous to think that anybody believed the military propaganda that thou shalt fall like beautiful cherry petals. And especially when I found out that of the 4,000 pilots who perished, 3,000 were intellectual cream of the crop. And they read thousands of books, original Latin, German, French, and all that. And I just could not understand. But at the same time, I was enraged by my own government. How could they send these young, idealistic youth to death? And so that was my starting point of these two books.
Well, to think that these students, these thousands of students who were so broadly read, would one way or the other have wound up, you know, subscribing to or at least bowing to this concept that they should die for the emperor or the empire?
Well, I think there are two things here. One is that Chicago Market Department wanted me to write the second book with hundreds of diaries, and I refused to do that because I wanted to follow their thoughts over the years. And I found these diaries, which one of them started even in elementary school. And what I found out is that when the country is going under brainwashing totalitarian regime, individual really is not all that indifferent to the propaganda. I think we all succumb to some elements of propaganda, and it is very interesting to see in the diaries, like Hayashi Jizo said, that there must be some meaning to die for the emperor. But then several days later, he says, that is not my thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can just see how they waver. But at the same time, second thing is that Japanese military state was going on for a while, and it was very hard for them to get out of it. Because all the students, Tojo government shortened the university stays twice. And unless you are in education or science, you are drafted. And then you are sent to the camp where the Japanese military was probably the worst in the world for corporal punishment.
Really?
And so if one of them would even sulk or something, and then entire members were punished. And so the corporate punishment was enormously hard. And then they were summoned at the hallway and was asked, those who want to volunteer, step forward, or who do not want to volunteer, step forward. By that time, for one, they know that they have been going through this enormously difficult days. And if they say that I want to save my life, that meant that the others should go. You guys go, mm-hmm. when they were all trained in the same camp. And then another one is that if they say no, they will be sent to even worse situation, like in the southern parts where the battle was going on. They will be killed anyway.
Killed mm-hmm. anyway, but with shame to their family.
Pardon me?
But bringing shame to their family at the same time, which would not be the case if they
yes.
were kamikaze.
Yes, but then the shame of the family was very much over, I think, exaggerated, because many of the mothers say that they did not particularly want that.
Mm-hmm. They yeah. didn't want their sons to be kamikaze. These mothers were saying that.
That's mm-hmm. right. That's right. And one, Hayashizu's mother actually was a poet and left many poems, one of which says that if only we lived in a different era, my son would not have been even partially eager to volunteer. Mm-hmm. So, of course, there are people who were totally brainwashed, but then there were others who really were skeptical. And then a diaries like Sasaki, who was a brilliant student at University of Tokyo, would shout in a blasphemous statements against the military government, you mm-hmm. fool. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't like everybody wanted to volunteer for the family or for the nation. And then two of them at the time of death said that they were desperately trying to find meanings for their meaningless death. And I think two of them said that if our death contribute to the destruction of Japan, corrupted by capitalism and egotism, but a new Japan would rise out of ashes like a phoenix, then our deaths would be meaningful.
Spectacular yeah. statement that they actually yeah. wanted the defeat of Japan.
That's right. So they were actually dying for the defeat of Japan rather than this
to save
this
it.
Victory.
Yeah, I was so struck by the material you have. I guess it's so different than the stereotype of the kamikaze pilot as a zealot, sort of unthinking, filled with nationalism and not wavering. And instead, you give these portraits of men who felt a lot of ambivalence, who were deeply educated and aware of so much more than we would think about. Can you back it up to the very beginning with the term kamikaze, which I think you say means something like God's wind, and where the concept comes from and why we have the stereotype that we do?
Okay, there are two things. One is kamikaze. Actually, Japanese would read it as shimpu, but it's a god's wind originated when the Mongolians came to invade Japan. And at the time when Mongolians are ready to invade Japan by ship on Kyushu, a typhoon started. And their ships were overturned. So they called that typhoon a god's wind. And at the end of the war in 1945, well, it started in 1944, the American radar system was so sophisticated that there was no way to attack them with a traditional strategy, military strategy. So the only way is to use this three types of kamikaze equipment. One is planes, and one is glider, and one is underwater torpedo. And for the first, this was invented by Onishi Takijiro, Vice Admiral of the Navy, and by going very close to the water, not to be detected. And that was the kamikaze plane. And the other glider was so ineffective, the Americans called them baka. That means fool, stupid. And then the underwater torpedoes were something that after close to the American ship, they no longer use that telescope. And so they have to blindly tried to attack the ship.
Oh, they couldn't have their periscope up.
That's
because
right.
They'd be spotted.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right. And so at that time, they said, the military officials said that only a miracle would save us from American. And they used the, you know, the standard technique of the military is the homeland invasion. I think we did that
yes.
in 9/11 too. I think every country uses homeland invasion.
Protect the homeland.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then if the Americans come, you know, they will rape and all of those. And so at that time, miracle was the only one to prevent the homeland invasion. And that, I think, had some psychological impact to this young men who were very idealistic. And one of the very touching thing is that they did not want to focus on their own success. They condemned those who are just going up the ladder in the profession. So they always question, what can we do to society, and what can we do to the humanity? Something, goals larger than their own benefits.
And the kamikaze phenomenon, as you were indicating, is actually something that comes along fairly late in the war, we say, toward the end of 1944. And it was only as the Allies, the Americans in particular, were progressing so steadily toward Japan.
That's right.
That the Japanese resorted to these suicide missions.
Yes. But then, you know, if you read the diaries, you realize they were not suicide. There, actually, I was talking about this to Pierre Bourdieu, who is a very, very distinguished sociologist in Paris, and he said, "Oh, it's a fate they choose." A very ironic, you know.
How is that? How is that different?
Because they had no choice.
That's true. That's true. That's an interesting distinction, isn't it? That yes,
yes.
they were not willingly laying down their lives. Their lives were already forfeited.
That's right. That's right. And so it's not really suicide.
It's interesting.
In fact, one Sasaki said that government is murdering us.
Mm-hmm. So, and how were they chosen? And you know, you mentioned that three quarters of them were sort of from the cream of the cream in terms of the education so on. Who chose the kamikaze pilots, and what was the thinking behind taking men who had had so much training, so much literature and the fine arts and everything? What was the thinking behind sacrificing those lives?
Well, first, as I said, that somehow government protected only those in education and those in science. And then those in humanities and social science were to be sacrificed. And especially, I think it's not as well known, but Marxism had been very strong in Japan. And even after the war, many of the publishers, editors were card-carrying Communist Party members. And so, for example, economics department was really a target of the state. because that's where the Marxists... Okay.
So they were getting
rid of... So
they wanted
to purge the communists and Marxists and lefting leaners out of the university system.
The liberals.
Oh, the liberals.
The intellectuals then would be considered dangerous.
That's right. That's right.
So if you were in a practical field like science or teaching, you were exempt. But if you were a philosopher type... who might be questioning.
But I think in trouble. They cannot select individuals, so their policy was to save these students in two disciplines, but then let the others go. But then afterwards, there are some selections. For example, by Constitution of 1889, all the sons of the emperor are supposed to serve. The oldest in the military, the second in the Navy. Mm-hmm. And actually, I talked with the brother of Showa Emperor, and he was describing this process. But then, of course, they would go. But then after they are told, those who want to volunteer step forward, but then the one that who choose among those would select. And they will never put the emperor's brother, you know, as the first one to volunteer. So,
and so these people who, I'll refer to all of them, not just the college graduates or the college students, but all of these pilots who became kamikaze, how many of them actually knew that they were being drafted specifically as kamikaze, or did they think that they were being drafted just to be pilots in the war? And then... later, quote, volunteered to be kamikaze pilots.
I don't know when they start to realize. All I know is that after they are drafted, and this is really at the very end of the war, and they were asked to volunteer. And it was really, they really did not have a choice at that time.
And what sort of training did they have so that they wouldn't at the last minute swerve, you know, because you would think instinct might kick in, the survival instinct. So did they go through some kind of process of indoctrination or training or psychological preparation so that they would stay on target?
I don't think they really had a choice. There was one case of a graduate of Keio University who could not spot the enemy ship. And then several times he returned, and he was just shot to death.
Oh, okay.
And so you either...
get shot by the Americans or shot by the Japanese.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, it was not...
But you could have just crashed into the sea.
Some of them tried, yes, yes.
Because in the novel that was used for the campus selection...
Ozaki's, yeah.
Yes, I know she mentions your work, but a kamikaze pilot... makes the decision to go into the sea rather than to hit the target. Was that just fiction, or is there any evidence that some of the kamikaze pilots actually deliberately avoided hitting a target?
I'm sure there were. The problem with kamikaze operation is that that was the very end of the war. And so we don't even have an accurate number how many perished and all that. And that's part of the reason why Americans have only this vision of suicidal plane coming down. And Leyte was the only one that was successful. And the rest, and it was very interesting when they said that those who want to volunteer, none of the professional soldiers volunteered.
How could they? How could they not?
Because they said that this is a stupid operation.
You mean the ones that were higher up in the military?
The ones, professionals.
Professionals.
You know, they were the professional soldiers.
Not and the drafted
ones. That's right.
Okay.
And the professional soldiers said that, well, this is such a stupid operation. And one who was real, he said that if the white feather is stuck on me, then I have to go. But I'm such an ace pilot. I can go and hit the American ship and then come back. Why do I have to go on this one-way mission where the bomb was so heavy and they did not have any equipment to return?
That's another distinction that I think has gone unmade, and that is that the kamikaze, according to what you're saying, Amiko, the kamikaze were not necessarily the best pilots in the Japanese military because the best pilots, they would want to come back.
That's right. That's right. They were capable of come back. So when they are forced to fly, they did because they're professional soldiers. There was no way to disobey the order. But they knew it was a stupid operation. It wasn't going to bring victory to Japan. They knew. Even 1944, in the diaries, the students said, "We have no hope for winning the war." That was the year before 1945 defeat.
There were some terrible ironies, it seems, too. One being, as you say, it certainly didn't win the war for the Japanese. It prolonged it because the kamikaze did inflict considerable damage on the American fleet, but then after a while, the Americans developed a strategy for intercepting the kamikaze.
Yes, only initially. Mm-hmm. I think it was more psychological.
Right.
They were not prepared to see this plane coming down. And
yeah. My uncle was 18 when he served in the Pacific in the U.S., and he said the psychological effect of having the kamikaze pilots land, that it made for a kind of it this idea that these people were giving up their life, mm-hmm. that had a psychological effect, that it had a very... You know, it was demoralizing in a way because it suggested such force, such power, such conviction. But it's interesting now when we look at the diaries to find the conflicted thinking of those young men that were going to their death. And we're going to hear some of the voices of these kamikaze pilots when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is Emiko Onuki-Tierney. She's telling us about kamikazes, and we're getting a look at that phenomenon from the diaries now of some of those pilots who went on missions knowing that they would not be coming back. You said that, about 4,000 kamikaze pilots? Did I hear that right?
Yes, about 4,000, mm-hmm. and 1,000 were boy pilots. And you mentioned about how they were trained. I think the Onishi, who was in the Air Force, who invented the Air Force for Japan, thought that if you train young boys, they would be better pilots.
Well, so because they have the reflexes, for one thing.
Pardon me?
They have good reflexes, for one thing.
That's right. And so 1,000 were boy pilots. Unfortunately, two things. One, I think they're much more susceptible to brainwashing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because they're not questioning through reading and all that. Second, however, they did not leave any writings behind.
Oh, sure. And how old? How old were these boys?
16, mm-hmm. Yes. Even younger.
So of these 4,000... You had these boy pilots, and then how many of them are people who would likely who have left diaries or even written letters for that many?
Well, 3,000 were university students, and varying degrees of writing. I think every country, England, America, had a tradition of writing diaries. And they said that writing diaries was the only way they can confront themselves, their thoughts, and also the way they can sustain their life in that miserable condition.
Mm-hmm. Did all the kamikaze take off from land? I mean, as opposed to aircraft carriers?
That's right.
They were all from land. So the reason I'm asking that is I know that at least technically, it was illegal for a lot of the American servicemen to keep diaries because the idea, of course, was that if that should fall into the hands of the enemy, then it would be valuable information. But I gather there wasn't that kind of prohibition for...
There was a lot of censorship. Uh-huh. And so many of the diaries were hidden under oil paper and then on top of it, they would say that since people, the civilians, no longer have rice to eat, but so they would put their own lunch on top of it. And then the visitors will smuggle out of their
base. Smuggle a diary out that
way. Interesting. Yes. And it would be a way to keep yourself alive if you get your words down on paper and get them out to someone. Do you have a favorite of all these diaries and sort of soldiers that you've met through their words? Do you have one in particular you want to start with?
I have two very different ones. One is Sasaki. He's very cerebral and very proud, and his thoughts are very interesting. There's another one. Sasaki is from University of Tokyo. Hayashi Ichizo is from University of Kyoto. Became Christian because of his parents, and he just starts to become a little boy to the mother. And he just very candidly talks to his mother in a language that was used only by a small kid.
And well, let's start with your cerebral one, the one from the University of Tokyo. Tell us what you know factually about him and give us a sample of what he writes.
Okay, would you like me to read that?
And where are these diaries, too? What is the source of all these diaries today?
First of all, they were published by a father or brother who did not want their brother or son's life to perish forever. Mm-hmm. So they paid their own. And then there is a very good small publisher in Kyushu, where most of the pilots flew off, who published. And then a larger publisher started to publish them. But there are tons more, and especially it will be interesting if I go through the letters written by women who were supposed to be guarding Japan and they thought. And there are letters. But may I read this night before the flight? Because this is the very elderly fellow who came to see me in a wheelchair because he was beaten at the base, you know, with a corporal punishment, and so he was handicapped. And but then he wanted to give me his thought. And he said, at the hall where their farewell parties were held, the young student officers drank cold sake the night before their flight. Some gulped their sake in one swallow. Others kept gulping down. The whole place turned into a mayhem. Some broke hanging light bulbs with their swords. Some lifted chairs to break the windows and tore white tablecloths. A mixture of military songs and curses filled the air. While some shouted in rage, others cried aloud. It was their last night of life. They thought of their parents, their faces and images, lovers' faces and their smiles, a sad farewell to their fiancés. All went through their minds like a running horse lantern. Although they were supposed to ready to sacrifice their precious youth the next morning for Imperial Japan and for the Emperor, they were torn beyond what words can express, some putting their heads on the table, some writing their wills, some folding their hands in meditation, some leaving the hall, and some dancing in frenzy while breaking flower vases. They all took off with a rising sun headband the next morning. But this scene of utter desperation has hardly been reported. I observed it with my own eyes as I took care of their life, which consisted of incredibly strenuous training coupled with the cruel and torturous corporal punishment as a daily routine. So this is what they went through.
So that's an eyewitness account of the last days.
Yes, and all we have in the media is that next day they had a headband and without, you know, they are going as for the Japan and for the Emperor.
So. And the Japanese media, I suppose, well, newspapers and radio both at this time, I gather I had nothing but good news to report.
Oh, yes. Daihon Air is the state radio, and they never they painted the battles very rosy.
Even when you lose an admiral and several, carriers. I mean, like the Battle of Midway, for example.
That's right.
Became a good thing.
And even battleship Yamato, which was stupendous, the largest aircraft carrier with all kinds of raiders to protect them. The people did not know about them. It was sunk to the sea by friendly fire.
Oh, really?
And so it was just... But the incredible thing at that time, it is a period of nuclear weapons. And then kamikaze epitomized the Japanese, I would call it almost stupidity, that the Japanese soul can bring about miracle.
Oh, could actually fight against something like
that's
that.
That's right, yeah. That's right.
Sort of a David Goliath thing, just that the small individual can somehow triumph over a big system. And did you do the translation yourself of the Kamikaze Diaries?
Yes, I did.
I'm guessing that there were some things that were probably hard to translate.
Yes, but it was not. But one wonderful discovery was that I was a little leery if the survivors would object.
Really?
Well, I did not know because there were some very intimate feelings.
Oh, sure.
And they are young people, and one is talking about the sexual desire and all of that. But they all thanked me because they were so pleased that their diaries are now read by far more people than those in Japan.
Mm-hmm. What's a way to make someone live and... I guess to give the life meaning.
Can you
give us a sample?
What thoughts then do we find? You mentioned this cerebral kamikaze.
Yes.
What thoughts does he express in his diary?
First of all, he expresses ambivalence, but referring to Goethe's Faust. And says that, two souls reside in my heart. After all, I'm just a human being. Sometimes my chest pounds with excitement when I think of the day I will fly into the sky as a Tokotai pilot. I train my mind and body as hard as I could, and I'm anxious for the day I can use them to their full capacity in fighting. I think of my life and death belong to the mission. Yet, at another times, I envy those science majors who remain at home. Oh, I think of those fellows who did not pass the draft examination and having managed cleverly. You can, purposely flunk out of the exam.
Well, familiar on both sides of the conflict, a familiar strategy.
Yes, I envy those who became bookkeepers or those who work at the headquarters. I'm drawn by my second soul to the earth. Perhaps this is inevitable. I can continue, but that's
a great description of the feeling of being torn into two.
That's right. And so especially those who are idealistic and who thought their mission was to be leaders of the University of Tokyo really emphasized that those who are at the University of Tokyo would be the leaders of the nation. And so they had that kind of a mission in mind. But they were torn because leaders of the wrong nation at the time or for the future. So they all hoped for a new Japan.
And Japan actually was at war in some form from at least the beginning of the 30s. I mean, in China, for example. So they must have known even in their university early days that the country was ramping up toward a military that would probably absorb them.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, you see, when Japan, Commodore Perry came in and opened Japan after all those years of closure, they realized the science technology of the West. But at that time, Japan was the only country in the Far East that was not colonized by the West.
True. Mm-hmm.
And so the first mission was to build the military. After, you know, they had just
sure
the
kimonos
and top notch, and they shed and then imitated the French and the English. And before the Constitution, Meiji Constitution, the military dictum was published, and they said that your life is like a feather, but your obligation is like a rock. And so expounded how you should sacrifice.
Well, it's interesting in the diary excerpt that you read that he's envying in some ways the bookkeepers, the ones that stayed on Earth. Is there a sense in his writing of what he would have done with his life had he not been sacrificed to the cause? Does he talk about what his hopes had been?
No, he did not particularly choose a profession, what he wants to do, but he was very, very idealistic, but also very perceptive of what was going on. And it's amazing how much, for example, he said, there is some sign of a new ethos for a new era. However, even though the material foundation for the new era is already being built, we cannot help but notice the legacy of old capitalism. If the power of old capitalism is something we cannot get rid of easily, but if we can be crushed, it can be crushed by defeat in war, we are turning the disaster into a fortunate event.
That's well, so it's interesting that at least in this set of entries, the conflict for the writer is not between, say, Japan and America. It's between capitalism and whatever you want to call it, Marxism.
That's right. That's right.
So he's coming from an entirely different direction.
Yes.
But when I say capitalism, I mean he's talking about Japanese capitalism.
Yes. Well, Japan was, as you know, very close to Soviet Union, Russia. And Marxism was very, very influential in Japan at all levels, actually.
And was it also repressed to some extent, though? I mean, I gather
it was repressed from the 1940s on. And my French colleague asked, why didn't you have a resistance movement?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and I think by 1940s, the Kempeitai, that is, police, was so pervasive and so strong that anybody who expressed opposition to the state would be jailed and most likely killed.
And you also had, we're very well aware by now of the relocations of Japanese Americans in this country, but you had relocations in Japan also during the war.
The foreigners or the children?
Well, the Japanese citizens, I mean, were relocated, were they not, during the war?
Usually the foreigners were gathered in certain places, and there were all of them are suspects. And in fact, that my father knew 5 different languages and had lots of foreign friends. And one Easter Sunday, we had a lot of white Russians. And so we were at the Easter celebration, and we were enchanted by colored eggs and candies and all of that.
These were Russians who were non-communist, non-Leninist Russians who had lost during the revolution.
It doesn't matter for the police. You know, they were all foreigners.
Sure.
And so they were all suspect. And so while we were enchanted by the Easter celebration, my father disappeared because the police was following us. And he was summoned to the police station for questioning. So that how much the police was strong in Japan. So that's part of the reason we didn't have this resistance movements like in France.
And how were the kamikaze treated in Japanese textbooks and Japanese reports? What was said about it?
Right now?
Or even shortly after?
Well, there was nothing to actually print. Right after the war, there was a famous incident of American occupational forces went through the textbooks and then used the black ink just to erase everything that could be pro-military. So there was no way that we could have written about the kamikaze pilots.
And there weren't reports of them during the war, I assume, because would you want to report that a number of pilots had gone out on a mission and not come back? Well, I mean, were they held up as examples?
It was a very, very secret operation. And mm-hmm. So there are writings by the lovers of some of the pilots or the parents mm-hmm. and how they would make journey to a base thinking that's where they can see their son.
Oh, really?
But it wasn't held up then as a heroic example of, I guess for some reason, I thought that it would have been celebrated almost as an example.
They were celebrated when they were drafted and all of that. But that was for every soldier. In other words, there was an interesting scene in Clint Eastwood, Iwo Jima, and how when the soldier is going off, you know, the people in town or the village would gather and then celebrate their drafting. And that is in the diaries, too. And so it was to be a hero, to be a soldier is to be a hero. But the actual operation was never disclosed, and then they moved the pilots from base to base so that nobody could tell. So there are cases of parents visiting, thinking he's there, and then he was already moved someplace else.
Did the families ever receive messages from the military that their sons had died in combat, these kamikaze pilots?
Much later, yes, and it became a very tragic scenes everywhere, because what they did was that they wrote the name of a pilot or any other soldier on just a piece of paper, and they put in a white box, and they wrapped in white cloth, and that's what they received. And so there's a very painful scene of Hayashi's mother receiving that, and then she just no longer could take it.
Mm. We'll look at some more of kamikaze diaries when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Amiko Onuki-Tierney, and we are talking about kamikaze pilots. She is the author of two books about the situation, Kamikaze Diaries and also Kamikaze, Cherry Blossoms, and Nationalisms. You mentioned when I asked you if you had a favorite of the pilots, the student pilots that you had been reading their words in the diaries. You mentioned first the one that we already talked about that was quite cerebral from the University of Tokyo. And then you also mentioned a second young man from the, I think, University of Kyoto, who became quite childlike. Tell us about him.
Well, he was a student at University of Kyoto, and his parents were converted to Christianity. And so he associated Christianity, reading Bible very closely with his mother. And he's the one who said that there must be some peace of mind for dedicating my life to the emperor. But then later on, he said, to be honest, I cannot say that the wish to die for the emperor is genuine, coming from my heart. However, it is decided for me that I die for the emperor. And that really kind of portrays the ambivalences that they had to go through, as well as their life is no longer under their control.
Pretty clear. And then does he start regressing, turning into more of a childlike voice?
Yes, and then he is age 22, and at that time you do not use a child language called okacha. that's only a little child. But then he regresses into that more or less a baby talk. And then he says, whenever I'm reading the Bible, I feel close to you. So he starts reading the Bible a great deal. And then being a Christian, he said that I'll be going ahead of you, but I wonder if I would be allowed to enter heaven. Mother, please pray for me. I cannot bear the thought of going to a place where you would not join me later.
And is he worried that by taking his own life, he would be excluded from heaven?
You know, that's a very interesting point. They never reconciled the Christian idea of suicide or others would prevent them to go to heaven. Japanese Christianity is a very individualistic one. After the Xavier of the Portuguese Catholicism, during the Meiji, American Baptism came. And it became very influential to the intellectual leaders, president of University of Tokyo, and or the Ichiko, which is the first higher school. But they all defied state as well as church authority. And so they established non-church Christianity. And so it was a very individualistic devotion. So they did not particularly follow everything that goes on with Christianity here.
Do we have any letters from family members that encourage these kamikazes one way or the other?
To tell them to die, so to speak?
Yes, or tell them to try not to die or anything. I mean, what kind of support did the family members give them, do we know, from letters?
I don't think I have not encountered letters or even in interviews how they really encouraged them to die. And, of course, the state did by they said that if you die an honorable death as a soldier, their family was supposed to get a lot greater compensation.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an incentive, and especially for those who are poor. But even there, the one that hires the boy pilot, that the cover of which is on my book, I talked with his brother quite a bit. And they were not very wealthy. And so the soldiers sometimes used as an excuse to explain to themselves that they have to die. In other words, if I die, you know, my family
will benefit.
That's
yes, right.
But that's on a kind of a – everyone tried to rationalize their death.
Yeah, and, well, as people will.
Yeah.
Right.
And so this was one of them. But – when you talk to them, mothers, the parents, the families never wanted to get in just to get money.
Sure, sure.
And you said that it's over, well, that we exaggerate the notion of the shame culture, that there were families where it would not have been a shame for.
Yeah, I think it's such a stereotype that has been enormously exaggerated, and I don't think that was the case.
For the families, but for the military, there was definitely this code of not surrendering.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you compare, for example, German percentage of surrenders with Japanese, I think the Japanese, maybe 5% of less surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
In the final analysis, did the kamikaze run out of pilots or planes?
Well, the planes were, when the Americans took over the Iwo Jima first and then Okinawa, planes were just shot on the airfield.
Sure, yes.
And then some of them even laughed how they had to board it up rather than. So towards the end of the war, there were no adequate planes to fly even.
But they still had kamikaze pilots lined up to fly them?
That's right, that's right. One of the most distinguished historian, Irokawa Daikichi, was waiting to be flown on a pilot. And he said that the mood of the soldiers waiting for that was just so low. And he said that he repeated some of the dirges that they sang rather than military songs.
So those kamikaze, potential kamikaze, were disappointed that they didn't have the chance to fly.
I don't think they were. But at the same time, many of them lost, like Irokawa just did not know what to make of life. And so he just became a farmer in the remote mountains until he returned to academia years later.
You mentioned that your publisher wanted you to include like 1,000 diaries, uh-huh, and you chose instead to be more selective. What did you use as your criteria for selecting a diary entry or a particular student?
I targeted those diaries that are massive. There are tons of other collection of diaries and letters. I did not go to them because they were just plugging it out. And then a couple of them are just very right-wing. And then the cover of that book was everybody smiling, ready to fly. Those are
right.
Boy pilots. But then when you look at them, they do not even identify the names of these so-called pilots.
So you
don't know when they were taken, the photos.
Yeah. So that would seem just propaganda.
That's right. There are a lot of propaganda.
I was going to ask, did they have the propaganda films then that they showed in Japan, especially to the pilots?
Oh, yes. I think there's a lot. So I don't know specifically the propaganda, but I know there was lots of film script to show how they are drinking the last sake. Before they fly. Yes. And as you know, the Japanese anthem is very boring and it's very short. at the end of the 19th century, English band director said, oh, you guys don't even have an anthem. Why don't you make one? And so it just said that until the rock gathers moth, that was the emperor.
Okay, that's it.
Yes. And so they chose another one, which says that there is a meaning to die for the emperor, you know, and then lie at the bottom of the sea or in the mountains. That became almost like an anthem. And every time they broadcasted that with the pilot going.
The image of the rising sun on the Japanese flag predates as well as goes beyond World War II.
Actually, it's a very ironic one because that was a Chinese designation of Japan.
Interesting.
Because from China, Japan is where the sun rises.
Sure, of course.
Mm-hmm. But then in Japan, you don't see that.
Of course, you're not aware that you are where the sun rises. Mm-hmm. But they've kept that all these years.
That's right.
And
that was one of the flags used by different feudal lords before Japan was united as a state. You know, Japan was just a bunch of feudal domains, 26 of them or something. Mm-hmm. And so there was no modern nation.
And what has surprised you the most out of all the work that you've done with these kamikaze diaries and the reactions you've gotten from people who have read what you've put together? What's surprised you where you didn't expect it?
I guess that at least in the circle that I talk with, first that I realized that it was not well known. The second, I was pleased to hear most of them very favorably reacted that by getting to know who actually they are.
People are glad to know these pilots as individuals, mm-hmm, rather than just as a stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've certainly told us a lot about this phenomenon of the kamikaze. And our guest again this time around has been Emiko Onuki-Tierney. Thanks for being with us again.
Well, thank you for having me again.
A great pleasure. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.